Today on Against the Grain, some causes make for strange bedfellows, but few like the campaign against sex trafficking, which brings together radical feminists, Christian evangelicals, the U.S. state, and even QAnon. Cultural anthropologist Gregory Mitchell separates myth from fact and examines how allegedly rescuing women and girls from trafficking, including at mega sporting events, leads to increased police violence, including sexual violence, against sex workers. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It would seem likely that enormous events bringing people together across borders, such as the World Cup or the Super Bowl, would lead to an increase in the coerced trafficking of women and girls for sex. And if you were to follow a variety of anti-trafficking organizations, you might conclude that such trafficking at sporting events is widespread. But my guest today says that isn't based on fact. He argues that, while we should oppose sexual exploitation, we should also be wary of the industry that has grown up purporting to rescue sex workers, which inflates the numbers of trafficked women for its own financial gain. Gregory Mitchell's argument can be found in Panics Without Borders, How Global Sporting Events Drive Myths About Sex Trafficking. He teaches women's gender and sexuality studies at Williams College. Greg, concern about sex trafficking has intensified in recent years, including on the right. Can you tell us about alarm around sex trafficking, especially child sex trafficking, by QAnon?
It was very interesting to me to be finishing a book about how sex trafficking has morphed into the kind of thing, the kind of discourse that can be twisted for various ends. And having just put the finishing touches on the first draft, to then within a matter of weeks to see the insurrection at the Capitol and to see QAnon. And of course, QAnon was, as the New York Times put it, it was kind of on the ropes a year before the insurrection. It seemed like it was kind of running out of steam. It had been deplatformed. And then they began their Save the Children campaign. And suddenly there were 1,000 new Facebook groups. And it really became a way for people to twist the discourse of sex trafficking and to put it onto all of these like mom Facebook groups and parenting Facebook groups in a way that wasn't that scary, right? Like it wasn't about, oh, there's a secret cabal of Tom Hanks and Hillary Clinton and they're trying to, you know, harvest adrenochrome to eat, you know, the glands of babies or whatever. That would sound completely crazy to a lot of people. And instead, it was based around a lot of sort of urban legends about saying, oh, you know, there's your child is thousands and times more likely to be sex trafficked than they are to get COVID. And you'd better watch out in the parking lots at Walmart and at Target and so on. And that, you know, felt a lot more reasonable. And it became a really easy way to bring people into the more conspiracy-sided part of the sex trafficking discourse. But people have been, you know, twisting the sex trafficking discourse to their own ends for quite a long time. And we've seen a really interesting set of strange bedfellows, as we say, of radical anti-prostitution oriented radical feminist groups, evangelical Christian groups, the police, who love the idea of sex trafficking operations because it usually means budget increases and overtime for them and so forth. And so you get this group of people that we don't usually expect to see together come together around this. And so we've really seen kind of the far left and the far right come together around this, even at a time when the rest of the culture wars, obviously, issues around abortion and LGBT rights, particularly trans rights, they're very far away on, and yet they all kind of converge on this discourse of trafficking.
Well, tell us more about the groups that make up what has been called the rescue industry, those who profess to rescue women and girls from sex trafficking. What sort of organizations are we talking about in the United States and beyond, and what sort of alliances?
Yeah, there's some really interesting ones. So Exodus Cry has grown much, much more powerful and has gotten a lot of publicity, particularly from Nick Kristof at the New York Times, who has been linking to and referencing their campaign against Pornhub, which is called Trafficking Hub, in which they try to really argue that the porn industry fuels sex trafficking, and that the only way to get rid of sex trafficking is to abolish all prostitution, all sex work, although they wouldn't use the term sex work. And that's interesting because, of course, Kristof and the New York Times really typify a kind of prototypical secular liberal approach. And Exodus Cry actually is the anti-trafficking ministry of a group called IHOP, the International House of Prayer, not to be confused with the International House of Pancakes, which would be much more fun in my view to visit. But that is a really powerful and very lucrative megachurch. And interestingly enough, it was the New York Times that did a very deep dive into the origins of their parent group of IHOP, International House of Prayer, which is based in Kansas City, but has prayer houses, quote unquote, all over the world. And this mega church, in addition to trying to stamp out prostitution, stamp out sexual exploitation as well. And I should hasten to add that I'm certainly not saying sexual exploitation does not exist in the sex industry. It absolutely does. But they also funded, and one of their founders, Lou Engels, was behind what listeners might remember as the quote-unquote Kill the Gays bill in Uganda, in which U.S. evangelical Christians were the ones trying to drive a law that would impose a death penalty for sodomy and same-sex sexual activity. And so what emerges is this idea that there are various sexual crusades that are kind of aligning, but also the mega churches are so big that I genuinely don't think that everybody in the anti-trafficking ministry is necessarily aware of what's going on over in the anti-abortion arenas and the anti-gay arenas, because these are really large, complex organizations. Another one of the key players on the sort of secular side is Polaris Project, which does a lot of really good work, but also feeds into a lot of this hype. They actually already, I just saw their first press release. We've barely finished with the World Cup in Doha, in Qatar. And they had already put out a press release saying, we need to begin preparing for the sex trafficking that will happen with the next World Cup, which is going to be hosted in 4 years jointly in North America between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And of course, depending on how presidential elections go by then, you know, there could be a lot more attention to the border and the idea of border security and all of this free crossings of the border. I think we're going to start to see a panic around that. But we also see various other groups involved in this on both the secular and the religious side, including the Salvation Army, including various Protestant groups in Europe, and even down to very, very local little NGOs and artists and individual church communities that want to try to be involved. And so they want to try to do something. And so they start donating money or having, you know, little 5Ks to have fundraisers. And then they give the money to these organizations, not necessarily realizing what all they're doing that might actually be at odds with what those groups would purport to be their core values.
Well, I want to ask you about precisely what you've been bringing up, which is the anxieties around sex trafficking at mega events like the World Cup, like the Super Bowl. But before we get there, it seems pertinent at this point to ask you how we should define sex trafficking and how we should see it within that larger category of sex work that might be coerced or consensual.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to understand where the whole idea of sex trafficking per se came from, which is from the late 19th century, from what historians now refer to as the white slave trade panic. And this was a very xenophobic notion that was pushed by, you know, yellow journalism, by Hearst and Pulitzer-owned papers that promoted the idea that immigrants, particularly Asian immigrants, immigrants from Catholic countries, were abducting good white women in the United States from things like soda shops and candy shops and, you know, ice cream parlors and that sort of thing, and were seducing them away, drugging them and selling them into sexual slavery. And the newspapers really promoted this around the turn of the century. And of course, a lot of this was about keeping out those various immigrants, Asian immigrants, Italians, you know, and so forth. And we have so many images and books and posters and warnings from that time that depict this. And that's really where we get the idea of sex trafficking, is actually out of this really racist notion, which frankly I think we see reflected in some films. Like, a lot of people know the movie Taken with Liam Neeson. It's kind of like we've got a vaguely Eastern faceless or personalityless entity that is, you know, somehow gonna steal all of these good white women and sell them off and besmirch their honor and so forth. And of course, there are many complex reasons that we don't have to get into about why they wanted to limit immigration and how that xenophobia arose when it did. But that's really where sex trafficking comes from. And that results in the passage in 1910 of the White Slave Trade Act, or the Mann Act, which is still on the books. And that forbid taking women across state lines for immoral purposes. It will not surprise listeners at all to know that that was used almost immediately in racist ways. It was used to stop interracial couples. It was used to target essentially anybody that the police wanted to stop, who, you know, had crossed over and who seemed in some way undesirable or disreputable. And they could use that to prosecute those men for sex trafficking. And so initially, the whole idea of sex trafficking hinged on moving people. Today, the anti-sex trafficking groups say, you don't have to move people at all. There is no movement across state borders. You don't even have to take somebody from one side of town to another. All you have to do to have committed sex trafficking is to have coerced or forced someone into prostitution. So we've had a huge expansion of what constitutes trafficking now that movement is no longer involved. But of course, different countries, different states even, have different classifications. Different organizations will use different definitions. So part of why we see these, you know, ridiculously high numbers, which I'm happy to talk about some of the numbers that become so ludicrous as to be kind of morbidly funny, is because the groups will count women and children who are at risk for exploitation of some kind, which includes things like children in the foster care system. And they'll say, oh, they're at risk for sex trafficking. And then they'll just lump them into those numbers and say, oh, we're going to have 40,000 is a particular figure that comes up around the World Cup, 40,000 women and girls sex trafficked for the World Cup. But they're counting all sorts of different configurations of people who are, you know, would not be considered sex trafficked. And it's very difficult to say who is at risk for sex trafficking. It's also important to note that a lot of these religious organizations, even if they're not outwardly anti-LGBTQ, they certainly aren't welcoming. And what we do know is that in terms of underage sex work and in terms of underage exploitation, there are a lot of homeless LGBT youth who are underage, who are engaged in survival sex, who are in situations that, you know, we can debate whether we want to call it sex trafficking or exploitation or prostitution, but who are absolutely not in a situation they should be in. And who has the money and the funding and the power to help them? A bunch of people who these children are fleeing because, by and large, that's how they got kicked out of the house, by their highly religious parents who are anti-LGBTQ. So the last people they want to go to are people who, you know, believe in things like conversion therapy and who are not supportive. So there's this homophobia that also undergirds, alongside the racism that undergirds this long history of the discourse of trafficking. So I just think we need to start thinking about new frameworks and new language, because my fear is really, after 16 years of studying this, is really that the whole discourse of trafficking has been so corrupted by everyone from QAnon to evangelical missionary groups to secular groups who also, you know, make money. And I'm happy to talk about some of the really prominent scams that have happened on the secular side, where celebrities have been duped into giving millions of dollars to secular anti-trafficking organizations that turned out to be fraudulent. You know, I just think we're at a point where we have to start really thinking about the complexities of exploitation that can happen within sexual migration. We have to think about the possibility that people, women in particular, can migrate under financial duress to a new country and they can sell sex. They can migrate and know that they're going to sell sex, but not know what the conditions are going to be, not know how bad the conditions are going to be. And that is a very different experience in which these women say, I want better conditions. I don't want somebody to save me. I don't want somebody to swoop in or, you know, to put me in a detention center and determine whether I should be deported. I just want to keep my money. You know, that's a very different kind of victim than the one that gets promoted by these other organizations that want this, you know, very melodramatic, almost soap opera kind of vision of a victim who is abducted out of a parking lot and chained to a radiator and, you know, experiences, you know, just the absolute worst sort of horror movie imaginable, which is not to say that that has never happened, but let's just say it's incredibly rare compared to the idea that someone with relatively few choices is moving across borders to sell sex and finds themselves in exploitative labor conditions that we could address through labor rights frameworks as opposed to white savior fantasies.
And we'll return to those questions as we go about how best to look at and understand the situation of these workers. I should say that I'm speaking with cultural anthropologist Gregory Mitchell about his book, Panics Without Borders, How Global Sporting Events Drive Myths About Sex Trafficking. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let's talk about the mega events, which have gotten a lot of attention for sex trafficking. As you mentioned, often a number of 40,000 is bandied about the number of women and girls who will be trafficked at each World Cup every 4 years. Obviously, the Super Bowl is coming up, and there are the same sort of tropes about the Super Bowl leading to an increase in sexual exploitation of sex workers. I wonder if you can talk about what might seem like a common sense assumption that bringing all sorts of people from around the world to a mass location would lead to an increase in not just sex work, but sexual exploitation.
Sure. Well, so the way that I came into this actually was that beginning in 2006, I had begun working in Brazil on my master's thesis, which eventually became a dissertation, my first book, Tourist Attractions, Performing Race and Masculinity in Brazil's Sexual Economy. And that was an ethnography of male sex workers, mostly straight identified, and gay sex tourists. So looking at following over several years, the complex relationships that these men cultivated. And as I was wrapping up work for that dissertation around 2012, we knew that the World Cup was coming to Brazil in 2014. We knew the Olympics were coming to Rio in 2016. And I began to see all of these raids that were happening that were targeted in the red light zones or prostitution areas, which also happened to be areas that were going to be highly visible to journalists. They were going to be located, the major sex tourist bar happened to be across from Copacabana Beach, where the big Jumbotron, they call it the FIFA Fan Fest, you know, which displays the games and all the crowds come, you know, it was across the street. And so the opening day of that World Cup, the police came with O Globo, who is sort of, at that point, it was kind of like the Fox News of Brazil. And this coordinated media and police effort came and they shut down this bar, even though sex work is actually legal in Brazil. pimping is not, trafficking is not, various things around the industry are not, but prostitution itself is not a crime. So we began to see these raids, and what I started to realize was that, you know, it was spurred on by Western anti-prostitution feminist groups, and I want to specify that there are also many, many feminist groups that are pro-sex worker rights and are not anti-prostitution groups, but spurred on by them, spurred on by evangelical groups, including some that I've already talked about, who just don't have the cultural competence and don't realize that when you say to the police in Brazil, of all places, hey, go clear out that red light district, clean that up. What that looks like is that they go into the brothels and they beat the women, and sometimes they rape them. I began to see more and more of this, and I began to say, wait, why does the cleanup, the World Cup, if they're worried about sex trafficking, why are they actually increasing violence against sex workers? And I and some other colleagues founded a research center called the Observatorio de Prostitución, or Prostitution Observatory. We say it. It makes more sense in Portuguese, because in English that sounds like we, you know, take sex workers to the planetarium or something. But but the Prostitution Observatory was really, you know, a policy watch group, and started to monitor the police raids that were happening. And they would occasionally arrest people suspected of sex trafficking and then release them immediately as soon as the press conference was over. But they would end up arresting the women, or they would evict them. And it was interesting because it was like, wait, if they're sex trafficking victims, why are you arresting them? And why do you have to beat them up and handcuff them in order to, quote unquote, save them? We began to see this more and more. And so that was how this book began, was me saying, wait, like, what is this? And then realizing, as I looked at South Africa, the previous World Cup, said, wait, I think the same thing happened there. And so I went to South Africa and began talking to sex workers and sex worker activists there. And South Africa is blessed with an amazingly organized, highly efficient, highly competent sex worker rights movement. They really, really have their stuff together. And as I met with them and I looked at the studies they had done during the World Cup, which included training sex workers to go out and interview and survey other sex workers and to journal about their clients and so forth, and they were able to do really good quantitative work. And I looked at what they had produced, and they had conclusively proven that despite, you know, the UK, there was a headline that said 1 billion condoms may not be enough for the boom that's going to happen in prostitution in South Africa for the World Cup. And so the UK sent, you know, 100 million condoms or some such figure, you know, to South Africa. And there was all of this, you know, worry about it. And it turned out that actually there were, depending on who you cite, it's between 0 and 8 cases of sex trafficking that happened during South Africa. And it's debatable even if the 8 cases were because of the World Cup. And so it certainly wasn't the 40,000. And so I said, well, if that's how it is here in South Africa, you know, how is this playing out in other places? And that led me to go to London, because there were similar concerns around the Olympics there. And then, of course, to do this 5-year-long project in Brazil over the World Cup, and then 2 years later, the Olympics in Rio. And to work, you know, with a team to collaborate with other people so we could really canvas hundreds and hundreds of venues for all 32 days of the cup, and to monitor very fine-grained things about prices and commerce levels and so on. And then I also went to Russia and looked at how things were happening there, and took two trips to Doha to look at issues there. So I really tried to examine this as a global pattern around these major sporting events. And the numbers just keep getting recycled. This 40,000 figure just kept coming up, even though it never had anything to do with reality. In the case of the Super Bowl in Dallas, this is one of my favorite examples. They kept saying 50,000 women and girls would be sex trafficked across the Mexican border, you know, to meet the demands of all of the people going to the Super Bowl. And then that expanded to about 100,000. And the Global Alliance Against Trafficked Women, which is a really wonderful anti-trafficking organization, pointed out, they said, you all are aware that that is enough for every man, woman, and child in the Super Bowl stadium to have their own sex trafficking victim from Mexico, right? This is just an inconceivable proposal that you're porting forward. And ultimately, the FBI had to do their press release and admit that they had actually found no cases during that, and certainly not 100,000. But by then, the overtime had been given. The police had gotten all their extra money. They can buy their toys and military grade equipment. And also, frankly, a lot of the overtime that goes into this is that they get to go hang out in strip clubs, frankly. You know, and they're getting paid time and a half for that. So we just never see this correlation actually bear out, but we do see everybody else jumping on this mega event bandwagon. They'll say, oh, a political convention, a Formula One show, or my very favorite example is the eclipse, which, if you recall, in 2017, there was this total solar eclipse that sliced across a very narrow band of the United States. Yet, governors general in, I believe it's Kentucky, Wyoming, and Nebraska, I think is the other one, asked for additional funding, and they began running all these headlines and saying, we're going to have workshops on how to stop the sex trafficking because there's going to be all this sex trafficking that happens during the eclipse in the middle of nowhere. And they said, well, you know, for that like minute and 46 seconds of darkness, like people could steal the children. And, you know, this also, of course, is reminiscent of what we see around the Facebook group saying the Democrats want your children to wear masks because it's easier to sex traffic them and to kidnap them. And so you just see this like weird creep into all of these sorts of things, because it's a really potent myth. And who wants to be for sex trafficking, right? It's something that everybody can agree to vote against.
The observation that you made in Brazil around the kind of crackdown on supposed sex trafficking, and the way that not only did it lead to greater resources for the police, but also increased surveillance, arrest, harassment of sex workers. Would you say that's a generalizable phenomenon that tends to happen, not just in the case of Rio, but around the world?
Oh yeah, absolutely. In South Africa, it was, I think, particularly bad because, of course, South Africa, the police never existed to actually protect, you know, poor, black, marginalized women. The police existed to enforce apartheid. And so, unfortunately, and, you know, this, what I say in the next few seconds will be a little bit graphic in case listeners want to skip ahead 15 seconds or so. But a lot of what was gathered in that data was actually that the police would abduct the women. There were complaints from the women that the police would put pepper spray in their vaginas. And that they would then dump them off in the bush, you know, many miles away from major cities. And so it was particularly bad in South Africa. In Brazil, I worked very closely with, there was a big raid where many of the women were beaten and raped in this building in the run-up to the World Cup. And only one of them had withstood the threats and said she was going to press charges and she was going to file a case and, you know, take it to court. And dubbed her for media purposes, of course, not using her real name, Isabel. And she was abducted. And she was tortured with razor blades. She was shown pictures of her children to, you know, threaten her that they knew how to get to her kids. We actually, colleagues and I, helped her to try to move her children out of the country, to move her into safety. And the morning that she testified before the Brazilian National Congress, her father's home was burned down. You know, there was significant backlash against anybody who tried to speak out against this. In Russia, and I was not able to visit these camps, so I don't want to concretely say that, you know, I know they existed, but I can say that the women I spoke to during the World Cup in Russia, in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but especially Moscow, were terrified of these camps, that they said that the police were taking sex workers and drug addicts and homeless people to clean up before the World Cup. And in Russia, you know, the old model in Russia was that the mobs were running everything, and certainly there was sexual exploitation in that. But more recently, it's the police. The police control these things and the brothels and so on. So there was no need to raid the brothels because they could just shut them down. But there was also a long history of the police doing things like bringing the sex workers to the police station and making them, you know, get on their knees and clean and scrub the floors and that kind of thing. And even in London, which was, you know, the police there, I interviewed people at Scotland Yard and the Lord Mayor's office back when the mayor at that time was Boris Johnson. You know, they said, oh, well, the police got out of hand. There were miscommunications. But part of what happened there was not so much sexual or physical violence against the women. It was that they could use the trafficking discourse. They could go to the areas that they wanted to take over and develop for the Olympics. And they could say, which I learned while interviewing a prominent NHS health worker who was on the committee with all of the mayor's folks and everything. And she said, all the landlords are complaining to me because the police come to them and they say, we know that you have women who sell sex who live in your building. We can prosecute you as a sex trafficker. Well, of course, these landlords are terrified. And so the first thing they do is evict the women from these properties in these highly coveted areas for gentrification, because they don't want anything to do with this. And they're certainly not sex traffickers. But the discourse is so scary. So even in countries where we expect less police violence or corruption, in fact, you know, we still saw severe abuses. And I imagine we'll see severe abuses at the next World Cup. And certainly we see, you know, some similar issues at the Super Bowl as well. So I would say, yes, this is absolutely a generalizable pattern. I think the one exception to that may be Qatar, the most recent host of the World Cup, in part because, and I did interview women who were sex workers, who were migrants, and they had their journeys facilitated by other people. So we could define them as sex trafficked, but they also came and went. They went home, back to the Philippines, or to Hong Kong, and And then they would go back and they would sell sex again. So, you know, it's again, not that stereotype of trafficking, but would meet the legal definition, I suppose. But in Doha, they were so restrictive in shutting down media, and they arrested British and German journalists who were trying to report on some of the labor abuses. You know, 6,500 to 7,000 men died building those stadiums. You know, those stadiums are literal graveyards. And they allowed so little media coverage that they just wouldn't allow in any of these groups that, you know, would normally have shown up for, you know, a major sporting event to try to monitor sex trafficking. It was just a total media blackout on that front. So it's difficult to say what happened there. But other than that, I would say it's been a generalizable phenomenon since the German World Cup, which I think was 2006. So we've seen it consistently since then.
I'm speaking with Gregory Mitchell. He's Associate Professor of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Williams College. We're discussing Panics Without Borders, how global sporting events drive myths about sex trafficking. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Greg, you've been talking about the strange bedfellows that have come together to oppose what they term sex trafficking. And you mentioned non-governmental organizations, religious charities, evangelical churches, secular nonprofits and feminist groups. I wanted to ask you, though, about the U.S. government and where U.S. funding has gone around what you are terming a kind of moral panic around sex trafficking.
So unfortunately, as so many things do, even in these other countries, a lot of this has been driven by the United States, and specifically it's been driven by the Trafficking in Persons report, or the TIP report, which is essentially a ranking of countries according to tiers and how well they are doing at trying to combat trafficking. And the TIP report, unsurprisingly, if you Google image search this, you pull up these maps and you look at them and you can't help but think, wow, that looks a lot like our geopolitical conflicts with various countries, right? But the thing is that if you slip too low, if you end up on the watch list, then you're warned that you may not get funding. And they also have, very, very importantly, an anti-prostitution loyalty oath, which says that no country can receive USAID money unless it commits to this pledge of opposing what they call prostitution. So that means that countries that have legalized or decriminalized sex work, so countries like Brazil, New Zealand, the Netherlands, etc., can't receive funds unless they say, you know, we are going to work to try to eliminate prostitution. Note, not sex trafficking, but to eliminate prostitution. So some of the goals concern things like reducing sex tourism. So in the case of Brazil, they lost $40 million in USAID funding because they had at their HIV/AIDS council, they had sex worker leaders who were using peer education, which we know is by far the best way for harm reduction. If I show up or I take my students to Brazil, you know, which I do, but I don't hand them clipboards and say, now let's go around and hand out condoms and do surveys and ask them, you know, that's just not effective. But if you have sex workers from the community who are trained to educate around HIV, to educate, frankly, around sex trafficking and sexual exploitation, those issues as well. We know that that's more effective at reducing this. But what was initially a Bush mandate, but was also pushed and enforced very hard by Obama, was a centerpiece for Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. So this has been very bipartisan. I won't get too into the weeds, but there were two Supreme Court cases in recent years brought by George Soros and the Open Society Foundation. And in the first, it had to do with the constitutionality of this anti-prostitution loyalty oath of not giving funding to U.S.-based groups. And the Supreme Court found in favor of Soros and said, on free speech grounds, you can't impose this. You can't withhold that money. And then essentially the same argument came in the international case from Soros as well. And that came just a couple of years ago. And the Supreme Court decided the opposite direction. And they said, we understand that the funding is all really tied together and it's really mushy and complicated, but ultimately these aren't U.S. citizens. And so we're going to uphold the anti-prostitution oath. So the U.S. in this very kind of neo-colonial fashion has pushed onto other countries this idea that you have to abolish all sex work in order to tackle sex trafficking, and that they're going to link money to it. That it's going to be similar to gag rules about abortion, about sex education, et cetera, et cetera. It's another instance of the U.S. using its economic clout in order to, you know, beat the rest of the world with a big morality stick that frankly doesn't work. It doesn't work to reduce HIV or sexual exploitation, but it is something that Democrats and Republicans can agree on. Because if you want to have anti-trafficking legislation, everybody can agree, let's vote against sex trafficking. You get to labor trafficking and suddenly you're saying, oh, wait, we'd have to do comprehensive immigration reform. Oh, we'd actually have to realize that exploitation can happen in picking tomatoes and, you know, strawberries and whatnot. And even though an important point that I like to stress with my students and so forth is sexual exploitation does also happen in labor trafficking. Women who are out there picking tomatoes can also very, very easily and are sexually assaulted and exploited and have nowhere to go. But they don't constitute a sex trafficking victim. They constitute labor trafficking victim. And so what I would argue is that we need a much broader framework that looks at labor and that looks at sex worker exploitation as a labor rights framework to try to get at this. But unfortunately, immigration and labor is a much more complicated thing than just giving some money to organizations that, you know, look like do-gooder organizations that want to stop sex trafficking.
Right. And of course, as you note, these issues around labor rights more broadly are consistently opposed by the United States as international frameworks for rights. I wonder if you could end by illustrating precisely this point, as you do in your book, Panics Without Borders, in looking at the situation in Qatar and Doha, where on the one hand, you've got women who could be termed sex trafficked, therefore sex work, although you, as you mentioned earlier, that's fairly complicated. And then you have a very large group of men who've been brought in as immigrant laborers who seem to be invisible in discourse around exploitation because their exploitation is this widespread run-of-the-mill variety of labor exploitation.
So the the one chapter in the book that I have that's devoted to Qatar stresses a few things. One surprising fact for listeners may be that around 95% of the people who live legally as residents in Qatar are not Qatari citizens and are not eligible to ever become Qatari citizens. So you have a very, very strange situation already in that you have a tiny sliver of the population with enormous power and enormous wealth. And then you have a large portion of the population that are sort of middle-class managers and are living perfectly fine lives. And then you have around 50% of the population live in these labor camps. And the labor camps are, incredibly squalid. Even before COVID, the communicable diseases and the poor conditions that were in there were killing people, and then COVID swept through. So when I give that statistic of 7,000, it doesn't even include the COVID deaths that happened as a result of that. But in Doha, I would go into the Western hotel bars, and suddenly sex workers would come up to me and they would, proposition me because they see me there as, a single Western man. And then the bartenders would say, well, are they bothering you? And I'd say, no, of course not. We're just chatting. And they'd say, okay, well, let us know. We have an arrangement. If you want them to go away, they'll go away. But if you want them here, then, we've worked that out. And I'm like, wait a minute. What do you mean you've worked this out? Wait, are you telling me that the Marriott and the Hilton are actually working with these third-party people, which I wasn't able to officially verify, but I'll tell you that I could absolutely say, oh, at this particular chain of hotel, all of the sex workers who are here in the lobby are from Taiwan or Hong Kong or particular places were known that that's where the Russians and Ukrainian women were. In fact, the sex work was highly visible. And what was invisible were these men. And I'm glad that they did actually get a lot of attention during the lead up, because so many of them did die.
Gregory Mitchell, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
We've been speaking about Panics Without Borders, how global sporting events drive myths about sex trafficking. That's published by University of California Press. Gregory Mitchell is Associate Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Williams College. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.